Before I do, can I just really say thank you? I know people have come here from different places and stuff like that, but to the Presbyterians, particularly from Freedom for Faith, we want to say thank you for your partnership with us, your affiliate membership, which lets us do the things we do and to speak some of your concerns into the public square. So thank you for that. We don't take it for granted at all, and we appreciate all you do in that area as well. It's nice too to be in Queensland. I was on the Gold Coast last night and I made the mistake of driving from the Gold Coast to Brisbane this morning. I thought that was a simple thing and Google Maps was really, really short. So everyone in his local is just shaking their head as I tell that story. So it's nice to be the out of town fool who does all the wrong things. But it's great to be here tonight. And it is, look, it is important, and I take it a lot of you have brought important questions, and so my aim really tonight is to not talk for too long and to leave space for questions. I think this event was pitched as the future of religious freedom in Australia, and we'd talked about the organisers had come to me and we talked about the very important Ruddock Inquiry, which is going on, looking at what laws might look like down the track, and we thought, okay, well, let's just make sure it's far enough off that it must be out by then. And so let's November, that's an outrageous date, far enough away. We'll know the future then. We don't. It's not out. And in its absence, I'm not planning to do a talk around leaked and misrepresented Fairfax reporting or to claim to be a prophet or Nostradamus or something like that, or to have any special inside track knowledge, which I can secretly share because I don't, okay? Instead, I think there are things that we can talk about from what we all know at the moment. And one of the really important things is for us to say, well, what do we mean when we're talking about religious freedom? One of the things that does get my goat is the expression comes to mind. I can't think of a better one on the spot. One of the things that annoys me is a lot of the time in media, you'll only see religious freedom in scare quotes. Religious freedom, right? Because, of course, we don't actually believe that's the true agenda. It has to belong in scare quotes because it's really cover for something else. And sometimes the accusation is quite explicit that those who concerned about religious freedom, it's really just a cover for some conservative political agenda or some kind of concern that only belongs to a few people on the religious right. It can't possibly be something that all of us are concerned about. And yet, if you think about some of the things that came out in that video, you think religious freedom is actually one of the great values we've had, that ability to be able to have different beliefs side by side, to say that you don't actually have to have the same belief as the king or the state is no small thing. And blood has been shed in the past over that kind of proposition, you know? And Acts 4 was a good place to start because I don't want us to think about religious freedom as some weird political hobby of people who have a, you know, particular political stance. Religious freedom is not some strange addition to the gospel. It's just a question about how you actually live out a very public faith. There will be other faiths that approach it differently, but let me talk explicitly as a Christian for the moment. The reading that we had from Acts 4, Acts tells the story of the church as it begins its mission. Jesus returns to the Father and gives the gives his closest followers there the Holy Spirit in order to take that message of him to the world, to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the very ends of the earth. So right from the start, the church kind of has this agenda which is public, and it's about speaking a message. You know, it can't be something which belongs just inside your head. It needs to have expression. It can't be something which just belongs in the upper room but needs to go out. You know, and as it goes out, as that message goes out, the very first time it does, the reaction is classic. They must be drunk. You know, that's the immediate reaction in Acts 2. So there's a PR problem with the church right from the start. You know, if you think it's just Sydney Anglican schools and stuff like that, not true. Right from the start, there's a PR problem that they've got to answer. The cause is being misrepresented straight away, and the defence comes. Do you know the defence? It's 9 in the morning, right? It may not be a good defence at a university setting or something like that. But in Jerusalem, at the feast time, it works, and they're able to then preach. But as they preach, again and again, you'll start seeing opposition come. Acts 4 is a good example. Acts 4, you get the message going out, and if you heard the words, it was that the message is that there's no other name under heaven by which men must be saved. Right? That's pretty hardcore, right? These are not people who are saying, oh, just be nice for niceness sake, and it's all about being lovely. Like, it's saying Jesus is the only way to the Father, and by the way, his tomb is empty, and by the way, you crucified him, and God will judge you for that. And the only way to be saved is to believe in his resurrection, right? They're not kind of pulling punches at this point. And as they go out with that message, 5,000 believe. We're also told that others doubt, right? So you have a situation where the rulers come in and their immediate reaction is not let's have a theological debate about that, but let's lock these people up. And there isn't a theological debate that says, is this true or not? They don't actually, if you look carefully, so they don't debate that at all. They just treat it like a public order thing. Now, I know in Queensland you've had great public order laws. You know, you don't always have a great history about free association of people who want to protest against the state. Well, a bit like Jerusalem in the first century, you know. They weren't crazy about huge mobs gathering under strange beliefs. That kind of thing needs to be shut down. And so the order comes from the very same people who had Jesus killed to say, you know, back to your upper room, speak no longer his name. You know, don't do this. In other words, you must go quiet. You must no longer speak this message, and it needs to just be a belief which at best is held privately, you know, rather than being brought into the public. And Peter, unschooled, ordinary man that he is, understands exactly what's at stake. What does he say? Well, let's think about it. He says, God has told us that there's no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. Now our job is just to take that name to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. May not be a smart man, but that's pretty obvious what I've got to do. And you're saying, speak no longer in his name. And we're only in Jerusalem. You don't want me to go to Judea and Samaria. And he says, what am I supposed to do? What's the choice here? Do I obey you or do I obey God? That's the dilemma. You create a situation where Peter and John have divided loyalties. To an extent, they want to obey the Sanhedrin and the rulers that are put over them and the chief priests and so on. But there's a deeper loyalty, which is that they've got to obey God. That tension is what's going to create the very distinctive Christian way of thinking about religious freedom. Now, the Romans never invented religious freedom. The idea that, oh yeah, we'll let our citizens have different beliefs and, you know, you don't need to worship Caesar, that was not on the agenda. They were bigger on kind of making human candles of people who had those kind of beliefs, right? And so religious freedom comes later out of Christian thought as they think about what it means to actually live out being, you know, a person wanting to... Well, let me give you Tertullian's word, 2nd century. He says this, the first person that we know that uses the language of religious freedom at all, remember, it just doesn't exist in Roman law or culture before, he says it is a fundamental human right, a privilege of nature, that every man should worship according to his convictions. It's assuredly not part of religion to compel religion. You know, it's a weird thing that these Christians start doing. They'll even make space, literally, for goat worshippers and things like that. That's okay. Let them do the goat worship. We'll do the Jesus worship. There'll be other worshippers over there. And we don't want the state compelling religion. Now, over 2,000 years, Christians will express that in different ways, that divided loyalty, that two ideas, the two kingdoms, the two spheres, that there's different ways they express it, but all of it gets back to that very first tension that the very first Christians have about who it is that they have loyalty to. And even today, if we see religious freedom in the paper and in politics, I want to encourage us to think about it as in terms of Christian thought, not in terms of, well, we've got this Christian thing over here and then we've got to think politically about this thing here, we can't see how it fits, but what does it mean to think Christianly about these issues? And some of the wisdom of the last 2,000 years is going to be helpful. And some of that wisdom that says, we don't want the state deciding that you must worship in this way and not that way. We don't want the state figuring out that we're going to enforce this set of beliefs on you. You know, the idea of religious freedom did not start a year ago in the middle of the marriage campaign. Yeah, it didn't start with talk of cake makers and things like that. And even though tonight is the anniversary of the announcement of the plebiscite result, let's think deeper and longer and harder and wider about it. Not because those things aren't relevant to religious freedom, but because we mustn't be defined by those who would ridicule religious freedom and who would seek to just cast it as the concern of some odd, eccentric kind of people. Let me talk a little bit about what's happened, though, in the last year. In the last year, we did see the laws on marriage change, and part of that parliamentary process and that debate that took place was the establishment of an inquiry into religious freedom. It had been raised by many as a concern, and therefore let's look at it. Let's see what the state of the nation is when it comes to religious freedom. The terms were very helpfully broad. It was not, they didn't mention marriage. Instead, it was all about religious freedom and the legal protection. Look at Commonwealth laws, look at state laws, look at whatever you need to so that we can have a well thought through submission and make it open to the public to make inquiries. A good panel, expert panel that was well chosen, well placed to speak into that issue. And the submissions came in. Enormous amount of submissions came in. 16,000 or so submissions. Now, in a pretty tight time frame, around the same time, the Banking Royal Commission's going on, and submissions are coming into it. And in the same kind of time frame that, you know, we're seeing that many submissions come in on religious freedom, there was less than 1,000 that came in on banks. Okay, who loves banks, right? As much as we don't like banks, as much as we're concerned about it, it just wasn't, you know, more have come in since, but it just wasn't generating anything like this. The response has just been enormous. And there is going to be, for the Bible College faculty in the room, it's going to be a very interesting snapshot of what Australians think about the relationship of church and state and religion and stuff like that to actually start reading those submissions. I'm not aware of research yet that's looked through it, but we've got to get onto that. 16,000, enormous. I've read hundreds of them, but I certainly haven't read thousands. We've got a kid doing work, we've got a young man doing work experience with us next week, and he's going to be reading thousands. He doesn't know it yet, unless he listens to this. He's a good guy. Okay, so it's what I want to say is that however it was that inquiry process came into being, and let's just acknowledge that it did come out of marriage debate and there were political machinations around why it might have been set up and so on, let's also say it's actually a great opportunity to say, what is the state of the nation? Where do things stand? And how is it that people want to see religious freedom protected? How is it that we kind of value that or don't? What are the views which are out there? And one of the things I want to say is that there's not actually a lot of law that deals with religious freedom. And so in its absence, a lot of the stuff that came in was how we think things should be done. And so it's actually if you're going to do legal reform, it's actually not a bad thing to hear people expressing how they think the law should operate, what things really are important to protect, what things they really do value. And as you look at the submissions, very broadly, I want to say they fall into two big camps. One that says, all is well. Religious freedom is okay in this country. In fact, it's better than okay. We might even need to pull it back a bit because it's doing some things which are bad. All right. So there's one kind of camp that says that. There's another camp that says we are genuinely concerned about some of the things that we see happening here and some of the things that we've seen through the West, and we are worried that there is a threat to freedoms and that we do need better protection legally than what we've had in the past. That this kind of cultural agreement to live and let live is fraying and we need more and better protection. Okay, and that, it's just worth stepping back a little bit and saying, isn't that strange? Isn't that odd? That an inquiry that's supposed to look at religious freedom is almost stumbling at the first hurdle because we can't agree on whether or not there's a problem. And that's unusual. Normally, if you're doing legal reform, you kind of know what the problem is, right? You're doing a Royal Commission into banks. Banks are the problem. Okay? Let's figure out how to fix it. We all agree on what the problem is. So let's have different solutions. But this time, you've got very different understandings of what the situation is before you. So how do you account for that? Well, one of the things that we should all be able to say is that we have enjoyed remarkable freedoms by any kind of global historical measure. We've enjoyed remarkable freedoms in this country. And when you look at the experience of people of faith through history, clearly that has not been the case. One of the things I've done this year is got to know a lot of the Jewish community leaders in Sydney, and so much of their thinking comes out of losing so many of their family in the genocide, in the Holocaust. And because of that, they don't take for granted religious freedom. You know, and persecuted groups throughout the world are like that. They understand that you can't just take these things for granted. So historically, that's the case. And, you know, clearly, globally, that is the case. There is a very important story about religious freedom we're not talking about tonight, which is the story of the persecuted church. And it's a story that's not understood and reported properly, and that we need to hear with tears and prayer for brothers and sisters through the world who suffer things that we just can't imagine and believe, you know. And that's not therefore to dismiss anything that's happening in this country. It's not to say, well, that's going to be the measure that we have. That would be foolish. But it's to say, let's appreciate the fact that we have enjoyed freedoms. And although there's submissions coming on both sides, I think that much we should be able to agree on. So I think we need to be a bit careful and slow to use any kind of language of persecution when we see what others are going through. But there are differences in that understanding. The all is well camp largely have framed an understanding of religious freedom out of a concern for equality rights, and particularly LGBT equality rights, coming out of the marriage debate. A lot of those submissions are at pains to talk about the hurt which is caused, they say, by the church to this community, and really is no more than an expression of privilege. The complaint is that religious freedom is just a cover for bigotry against sexual minorities, and it does belong in scare quotes. And if you read these submissions and take them seriously, they say, look, they've got freedom to worship. They can go to church, they can say their things, they're not going to be forced to marry people against their will, they'll concede that much. But no more. If religious freedom butts up against the rights of an individual to express who they are and their dignity rights, then it needs to stop. That's the limit. You know, that is a deeper and bigger kind of concern. And therefore, when you look to whether religious freedom and protection is adequate, you ask questions about whether people can worship and go to church. And you have to say yes to that. If that's the measure, then religious freedom is sufficient. And if that is the right understanding of religious freedom, that it should fall away when it comes up against other competing rights, then you might want to do legal reform which pulls back the right of the church. And so it's no surprise that we're now into school debates about whether schools are able to employ according to their ethos and belief, and whether a Presbyterian school can be Presbyterian in the way it conducts itself, or whether it needs to follow the same kind of code of conduct that any other school, state or otherwise, will follow. You know, they're the issues that will come from that kind of view of religious freedom. And on that understanding, rights are really a zero-sum game. You know, if you have rights, then it's in competition with mine, then one of us is going to win, and it's a power struggle. And really, that's all that we can talk about. It was captured well in an event that's taking place tonight in Sydney, protesting outside some of the churches at schools, and it says this, quoting from the Facebook invitation, Morrison's religious exemptions, in square quotes, is nothing but a disgusting attempt to enshrine homophobic, transphobic discrimination in law. 1 year ago, a majority of people fought and voted for equal rights and treatment for LGBTI people. On the anniversary of our victory, we need to stand up once again against homophobia and transphobia. So the catch cry here is no exemptions for equality. The thing that counts above all else is equality, individual equality. Particularly expressed this in terms of my sexual identity and who I am. My dignity stands on this, and people who want to oppose that are opposing who I am at the deepest kind of core of my being. Now, I'm guessing you've heard that argument. And I think one of the things we need to do is listen carefully to it and feel its power. Because it does tap into the great Australian virtue of equality and a fair go. The language which is used is brilliant around it. It's about allowing people to be who they are. The idea that you would oppose this is inexplicable to many, and many even inside the church. Many youth within the churches would say, look, I kind of believe these things for myself in terms of, you know, what it means to follow Jesus, but I can't understand why I would impose it on others. You know, this feels like something which is wrong, which I'm being asked to do. And I know of youth leaders around the country that were saying that very thing to their youth groups who were looking for guidance. Not that they got a vote, but, you know, they were being trained. Many who had this kind of instinctive reaction to say, I don't think it's right, really felt that it was not okay to say no, and that they would be publicly kind of shamed if they took a position like that. And I think some of that has played out. So again, sorry to use a Sydney example, but just over the last month, we've seen a number of school heads of Anglican schools that have gone out and have said, look, you know, this is where we kind of take a stand, and their photos are in the paper. And it was a kind of public shaming campaign, not mischaracterising it there. That's how it was described by those who were organising it against the schools, you know. We need to shame them. They need to understand that things they're doing are disgraceful and wrong. Okay, so there's kind of one understanding of freedom. The second submission, and by the way, I want to say, until my work experience kid tells me otherwise, my feel is that those submissions are in the very significant minority. I don't know what the numbers are, but my guess is maybe somewhere between 5 and 10% of the submissions that came in were expressing those kind of things. Now, that could be completely wrong. Let's wait for work experience kid to give us the right answer. But that's my gut answer, having read a few hundred. Right? Now, that's not the read that the media gives, right? I would say from the media point of view, that's like 95% of the characterisation of how to understand this issue. So there's a gap between those that are concerned enough to put a submission in and the ones who are writing this up in the media. We need to feel the power of it, though. We need to feel the force. We need to not just kind of dismiss it, but to understand where people are coming from and to actually eyeball and get to know the people who are saying it. The second camp, the ones who are saying there are threats to freedom, most of them started with marriage, but many went beyond it to say, look, this really isn't just about marriage. This isn't about just whether a minister is going to be forced to marry. That frames it too narrowly. It's about whether we're going to have the freedom to live out beliefs. It's about whether we're going to have a freedom to dissent on this kind of stuff, to actually have a position which is different from one that a political party might choose to have. And it is a different understanding of what freedom is really about. It's saying freedom needs to be more than just a private belief inside my head. It needs to be more than just whether or not a minister is going to be forced to marry. It's something that affects all people of belief, not just ministers. It's something that is not just at a marriage or at a church service, but it's what takes place when you walk outside the church door. Because it's a different understanding of what faith actually is. It's a holistic kind of understanding that says the faith is going to be a public one. It's going to involve speaking. It's not going to be something that just takes place inside an upper room where we say things to each other in small groups. Right from the start, Christianity has been public and unashamedly so. Now, we've got to think about how to do that graciously and speak well and those kind of things. But the idea that religion can kind of be boxed into this secular kind of frame that says, you know, this far and no further, and that religious freedom is narrowed to a freedom of worship that just kind of stops when morning tea finishes at church on a Sunday morning, that's the objection, that it fails to account for this whole of life thing that will find expression not just individually but communally. That this is not something which is just about me and my belief, which is private, but public and gathering, like we're doing tonight, like you may do at church on a Sunday night, like you might do at a synagogue on a Saturday, that it's a corporate thing. And interestingly, the international law on religious freedom expresses those same kind of concerns, that this is not a narrow kind of freedom of worship thing, but a broad thing. It includes the freedom to gather together, includes the freedom to raise your kid according to those beliefs. It includes the freedom to set up institutions that express those kind of beliefs and put them into action. It's not just about loving God, you know, but also loving your neighbour. And therefore, we want to set up charities. We want to set up hospitals. And we want to do it from Christian love springing out as the thing that drives it. That's the kind of different, broader kind of frame. And what it does is then it says, well, it's not the job of the state to jump in at that point and to say, well, yeah, you might want to express your faith in working it out, in setting up this charity, but really it's the state's job to figure out that. And the state's job is about, you know, making sure that everyone's individual rights are just being protected. Well, if you do that, then you're kind of losing this whole way of being where the faith is being lived out. So, they're the differences which are at stake. And there is some truth to say it's going to take time for those different ideas of freedom to find expression, to find some of the problems that are likely to arise as they have throughout the West. But the other thing I do want to say very clearly is that there's not much legal protection. Whatever your different philosophy and faith and political thoughts coming into it, there's not much here on the books at the moment that protects religious freedom. There's a section in the Constitution that doesn't do much at all. Section 116 in the Constitution will be... When they set up the Constitution, 1901... it was great news for Presbyterians because it stopped the Anglicans being the established church, right? And so it was a means to buy off Presbyterian support for the Commonwealth, and probably in bigger numbers, Catholics, as my family were at that time, Irish Catholics worried about these Anglicans setting up the Church of England in Australia. Let's not have that, right? No power to establish a church, no power for religious tests in office. Borrowed a couple of things from the American Constitution, but the High Court's never, ever used them much. They've interpreted it so narrowly that you've never seen laws overturned because they breach Section 116. So it sits there, not in the section that deals with the states, but it doesn't even bind the states. So state governments can do what they want. State government can absolutely stop all kinds of religious freedom. It's just the Commonwealth can't have those kind of laws. So the idea that the Constitution protects us, well, it just doesn't. And more importantly, it's not just about the law. You know, think about the culture that creates a Constitution. A Constitution, you're kind of saying, this is who we are. This is what we really stand for. So in America, everyone knows that liberty is, you know, your first freedom. Liberty in Australia is a Subaru, right? We just do not care about liberty. It's not who we are. And so the Constitution doesn't express that. You know, it wasn't needed in order to bring us together like that. The Constitution is not like France. We don't set it up, you know, to say we are the, you know, a secular state. This is who we are. It's not like the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, which says we are religious, you know. Each different culture is going to set up different constitutions that say this is how we do life together. And the Australian Constitution might have well said, no worries, when it comes to religious freedom. You know, we've got very, very thin protection that doesn't do much at all. And you know what? As long as the culture is no worries, we've got no worries. But once the culture starts to worry about religious freedom and religious people and starts saying what these religious people are doing is dangerous and harmful and we need to be protected from them, and so do our children, and we're not sure about them having these kind of protections and maybe they should be wound back, then all of a sudden the cultural no worries agreement is gone and people of faith are looking very, very vulnerable. And the point at which it's really pressing at the moment is in anti-discrimination laws across the country, where crazily the rights which have been given to all these other groups to say, look, you know, that you must not discriminate against these people on this basis, there's an exception or an exemption for churches and faith-based institutions so that they don't have to kind of follow that law. Because otherwise you get absurd kind of results where, you know, the Catholic Church would have to have female priests and things that it doesn't actually believe on. And so for a long time, in a no-worries culture, you can have those kind of exemptions, you can get along like that. But now you see everywhere, in every jurisdiction, those exemptions being chipped away because they look like inexplicable kind of concessions to bigotry. Why should we give the churches the right to do that? No one else gets to do that. So one of the things we're arguing strongly is that that is just something that we will not be able to defend. And there is a right objection to that that says, you know what, it doesn't really fit to treat faith like that. We don't actually think that faith should be an exception to a general law, and what we're really interested in is discriminating against women. So for the Catholic Church, what they want to say is we actually instead understand the priesthood in this way and we want to express that. So we were saying flip it around, get rid of the exemptions and let's have a positive right to belief. You can quiz me on the technicalities of that later, but that's one of the big things we've been arguing. But the deeper point is just an observation that the culture has changed and with it the laws, sadly, are going to need to. What does that mean? What does that mean for the churches? I want to say a few things just quickly. I'll just fly through this and leave it for you to pick it up if you want. I want to say, if you haven't noticed that the culture has changed, you may have been in a coma or something. I don't know what's taken place. But the culture's changed and shifted. And talk to your kids and grandkids, read the paper, and you'll see that we are no longer in 1990, you know, or 2000. Things that made sense then do not make sense now. And yet, we know churches are still, they're not always the most nimble, fast-moving, responsive organisations, you know. It's great to see all the tech that's running here tonight, but I have spoken at places where they still have, you know, the plastic slide with the light projector? I don't even know what they're called. Overhead projectors. I've seen people running overhead projectors. When it comes to religious freedom, sometimes people are running on overhead projector kind of thinking. Like, you know, like it's not just a tech question, but it's a just understanding that things have changed around. And I think most people are getting that now. And if this year doesn't wake you up to that, I don't know what will. So let's think about that and let's appreciate what's going on and think what might the future look like. Because some schools... some churches are making kind of foolish statements at the moment that say, hey, we don't need these exemptions. We'll never need them. We don't even need anything in their place. We'll just go bravely on into the future and things won't change. And I want to say there's actually a revolution that's been taking place since at least the 60s and maybe before that into the Enlightenment that says you know, the church is kind of the enemy here. It's the problem that needs to be fixed. And you're just naive to think that you could go that way without consequences coming. And I think we're starting to see some of that play out. And there are state governments that bring agendas that are quite explicitly aimed at taking away some of the freedoms that people have enjoyed for a long, long time. But how do we react to that? The first thing to say is that there is no place for fear. Okay, we're not to be people of alarmism, nor are we to be people of naivety. But fear is not a Christian habit of mind. You know, if there's a refrain that takes place through scriptures, it's do not fear, do not fear, do not fear. There's a trust that takes place because of the sovereignty of God that is not something that just belongs in a textbook that Calvin wrote, but says this is normal Christian life. To expect opposition and persecution and things like that has been the lot of most Christians in most places in the world. So do not fear. God is faithful. And therefore, pray, don't panic. Be people of hope. Be people who love your enemies. Doesn't say don't have enemies. There may still be enemies, but you've got to love them, right? Now, all of these things I'm saying, that's just normal Christian living. And I want to say, let's think about religious freedom as just normal Christian living rather than some weird, strange addition that suddenly you've got to play some bizarre thing that you've never, ever done before. It's actually saying that you can go right back to the church in Corinth and see it struggling with issues of identity and holiness and purity and same-sex attraction. And these issues are not new, and the scriptures are still rich to speak to them. And for 2,000 years, Christians have been looking and learning to see what it means to, you know, include all in the love of Christ and to see hope for all. You know, there is some profound thinking that we've got to immerse ourselves again in from Scripture. We need more of it, not less. One of the distinctive things that we're trying to do when it comes to religious freedom, oh, I say distinctive, it's really hopefully it's a Christian thing, is to argue for pluralism. Right, to be able to say, you know what, we actually want to be able to have different beliefs sitting side by side. That is not the same as relativism, which is that it doesn't matter what you believe, they're all basically the same, right? Pluralism is Acts 4, where you say, you know, we've got to obey God. We've got to do the right thing here in this situation. And the Christians will go on to say, and others will have to do that as well. But they believe in the uniqueness of Jesus. And for a church which, generally speaking, is as conservative as the Presbyterians, it can be hard to stretch to that way of thinking sometimes. I say that as a Sydney Anglican. You know how unreconstructed they are, right? But you need to be able to hold both things together, to be able to say there is a truth which is unique in Jesus that we give our whole life for, but we want the freedom for others to hold beliefs which we're absolutely convinced are wrong. You know, we want them to have the same freedom that we do, and we want to be able to talk across that difference. And we don't want the state figuring out who really has true beliefs. Because, yeah, they might say tomorrow, you know, this group of Muslims aren't true believers, but guess what? The next day it'll be Presbyterians, who are the great enemy of the people. The state should not be trusted with that kind of authority. So we must be people who are concerned for the freedom of all, and not just for the special pleading of Christian rights. One of the things I want to say is too that this is all coming at a speed and a scale you will underestimate because everyone in the country has. Okay, I'm trying to remember the first time I was speaking to Freedom for Faith leaders around this, and I think at the time we were thinking, could be 15 years, we might see some of this stuff play out, and it's been 5. And so people who are saying things could happen in the future, that, you know, could go in this kind of direction, I want to say they probably will, and it'll probably happen faster than you believe, and it'll probably be bigger than you can imagine. And so don't dismiss the people who are saying, you know, let's not be naive, more is coming, because it is coming. Just case in point, 3 weeks ago we had in the Senate Darren Hinch stand up with a motion to say, turn over standing orders. The thing the Senate has to do right now is debate whether or not there should be defunding of faith-based schools that discriminate in any kind of way. And that vote went 31-30 to drop all the other business of Senate and to get to that. One vote. So this is something you might think, oh, that would be years off that we'd be talking about. It's already happening. Okay, it's already on the agenda for the political parties figuring this out. So let's not be naive. You know, let's actually find out what's going on. What can we do about it? Well, some of the things we've already been saying. Pray, love, hope, get involved, do that kind of thing. What does it mean to be involved? Rohan had asked the question before, at a practical level, what does that look like? I want to suggest three things. One is all Christians must pray, right? That's just obedience to God. It's a really significant thing to do. There's nothing more strategic than you can do. Remember talking to one cabinet minister, I won't name, who said, who I don't think is, I'm pretty sure is not a Christian himself, but he said, look, late one night I came back and I had this tray to deal with, which is this deep, and every single email that was printed out, he prints out his emails, how is that? But that they, everyone was asking for something from him. Give me this, 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 except one. And it was just the letter that he'd received something like it before from the local church that said, just want you to know we're praying for you. There's no ask. It was just, and it wasn't a boasty kind of thing. It was just, here is a church that does what God asks them to do, pray for the rulers. You know, and when you start looking at those prayers, you can see there's actually a lot of content fleshed out, some of which speaks to religious freedom, like that we might be able to live quiet and godly lives. So three levels, if you want to think about. One, pray. Everyone must do that. Second level, it's good to connect with your local MP. It's good to speak to them. They're human, right? They don't always understand the issues and they rely on concerns. They're your representative. And so let them represent you by speaking to them about your concerns. You know, don't complain afterwards if you haven't spoken before. And I think we need to step up a bit in that. I think it's not enough to think, oh, well, ACL will do that. Freedom for Faith will do that. My bishop will do that. Someone will do that, you know. But instead to say, for some of us, that's a good thing to do. And maybe that's you. And the third thing I want to say is, for some people, third level you might want to think about is some of you should actually get involved. It could be that you join a party. It could be that you organise others in letter writing or in visiting people or in talking about issues. It could be that, you know, you're at uni and you've got a choice between being a lawyer in advance, tax and corporate greed, and you can be brilliant and make lots of money, or you can have a very difficult time doing all the left-wing kind of subjects where you misgender people all the time, but you end up being able to being the diversity officer for the Department of Education. Now, that's a role that makes a huge difference to religious freedom in this state. It'd be a very difficult thing for someone to do, but it'd be a good thing. I'm not saying be secret and sneaky about it. I'm saying bring those Christian convictions into spaces that you might think won't be as much fun. In the absence of the report coming out, we are waiting. And yet, I think you can see that there are some deep questions that we've got still unresolved as a nation about how it is that we're going to do life together. A lot of the assumptions that we've enjoyed for a long time seem to be going out the window. There is, at the same time, a difficulty to speak well. And so we, of all people, need to be graciously engaging in this space and being prepared to hear different points of view. Look, I hope tonight is part of that. And I hope it helps equip you into that space. And that's certainly been the prayer coming in. And so I'm going to hand it back to Rohan. We're going to do some other stuff, but I'm really looking forward to your questions. Thanks.